Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up this week, it's a live event that you don't want to miss. The Crop Consultant Conference is this Thursday and Friday at the Visalia Convention Center. We've been previewing it for you the last few weeks, and we continue today. We start with Taylor Chalstrom.
Hi, this is Taylor with the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm here with Silvano De Luna with Water Rights Technologies. Silvano, can you tell me your affiliation with the company and a little bit about WRT?
Yeah, and also what I do for WRT, I'm a crop consultant, and you know, we go around and we help people out with various things in agriculture, depending on their growing season. Depends on what's going on with them.
And can you tell me a little bit about what WRT will have kind of on display or be presenting at this year's Crop Consultant Conference?
Yeah, so what we're going to be presenting is a way of thinking. So we have about five different product lines that we distribute. And what we do is we kind of figure out what the problems going on with the different various farmers and the different crops. And then we kind of tailor our advice towards, you know, each individual particular grower. So what we'll have is we have a bunch of different materials, fertilizers, some NPK with micronutrients. Then we also have like an organic fumigant replacement type of deal. So we do all sorts of stuff. But the main thing that we do with WaterRight or WRT is we do crop consulting, and we have the best intentions for our growers. That's what we, you know, tailor our business towards.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Silvano. And we look forward to seeing you at this year's conference.
All right, perfect. Thanks for the call, Taylor.
Thank you very much.
I am Janine Larimore, and I am the Northern California rep for Pacific Biocontrol.
All right, to start off, tell me a little bit about Pacific Biocontrol.
Pacific Biocontrol is a pheromone mating disruption company that has been in business for well over 30 years. And our products are the isomate products, and they're designed to be used in multiple crops, and they are meant to be a season-long mating disruption product for coddling moth, for oriental fruit moth, for navel orange worm, and now for vine mealybug.
And then you have a new product that you're just announcing, and it comes right alongside the same time that we're having this conference. So tell me about the new product you're excited about.
We are very excited to announce the registration of our isomate vine mealybug, which will be available in 2022. This is a product that we designed to, again, last the entire season, to be deployed in the spring and last all the way through that fall flight, which is really crucial in vineyards. It's designed to go on simply a twist tie dispenser and not be removed through mechanical harvesting. And again, it will last 180 to over 200 days that we've seen in the Napa region. So we're excited to get it on the market.
And then the only other thing I would ask is, as people come up to your booth and talk to you at the conference, what is the bit of information about the company you hope they take away with them?
We really hope they understand that Pacific Biocontrol is a company that prides itself in strong research and strong product support. We know that pheromones are, you know, new to a lot of people, and so we like to help them understand expectations and what they're going to get from our products. And we're happy to meet with them in the field and again, give them the support all season long that they need.
Thank you again to Janine. Taylor is also back with more on the conference.
We're here with Laura Crawford from Belgium Crop Protection USA. Belgium will be one of our sponsors at the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference next month in Visalia. Laura, will you tell us your affiliation with the company and a little bit about what you guys are about?
Sure. I'm Laura Crawford. I'm the regional sales manager for Belgium Crop Protection USA. Cover California to Texas along the southern border. We have a few different products. We have our own proprietary products as well as some generic products. In California, we mainly sell micronized sulfur, Cosavet DF Edge. We also sell tebuconazole, a product called Buzz Ultra, and imidacloprid, and a product called Imidashot. Integrate 80 is our soil surfactant. Spinade is a product we use specifically on spinach for broadleaf weed protection. And then our final product would be Unicorn DF, a Teb and Sulfur premix.
And Laura, will you tell me a little bit about what Belsham will be showcasing at the Crop Consultant Conference next month at their booth?
Sure. We will be having samples of our Omidishot product. So stop by and pick one of those up if you're in the area, and we can talk about that. That's Omidishot is imidacloprid. I also will be showcasing Cosavet DF Edge, Buzz Ultra, Spinade. Those are our popular ones in California. And we're working on a registration on a new molecule that we've recently registered in other states. We're working on starting the registration process in California, but as we know, that takes a little bit longer than other states. The product is called TUF 5EC. So if you want information on that one's a new molecule, and it's for resistant weeds in corn and mint.
Perfect. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what you guys have to offer at the conference, and we will see you there.
Great. Thank you so much for having us, and it's going to be great to see everyone in person again.
For more about the Crop Consultant Conference, you can go to myaglife.com and click on the link that's in the upper left-hand corner. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns live in person on September 16th and 17th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this must-attend conference features 2 days of educational seminars, a live trade show, and honorariums and scholarships given by Western CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Hear the top experts in their field speak on pest management, artificial intelligence and new technologies, as well as the latest on soil health, nitrogen, and irrigation management. DPR and CCA credits will be available over the 2 days. For more information on credits, topics, and registration, visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
AgroMiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpak R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpak 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Welcome back. Here's your news for today. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals denied a petition for a rehearing in the case of the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers versus the EPA decision. In that case, the court vacated a 2019 regulation allowing year-round sales of E15. The Renewable Fuels Association, Growth Energy, and the National Corn Growers Association released a joint statement expressing disappointment. The Nutrition Incentive Program, honoring a former USDA undersecretary, recently awarded grants that expanded focus on systems impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Rod Bain reports.
Gus Schumacher, a name associated with USDA as undersecretary of the then Farm and Foreign Agricultural Service in the Clinton administration. A name associated with efforts in sustainable food and nutrition systems, both in the District of Columbia and around the world during his lifetime.
He really wanted to see it enhance the resilience of food systems, and now we've added the component with the healthcare system, and especially during times like the pandemic. And how do we improve the affordability and consumption of fruits and vegetables by vulnerable participants in communities in need?
And as Suzanne Sluka of USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture points out, that legacy lives on through the namesake Gus Schumacher Nutrition Incentive Program. Recently, NIFA grant awards were given to projects designed to build more resilient food and healthcare systems, including those impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
There were awards for the Nutrition Incentive Grant, and there were awards for produce prescription grants.
Nutrition Incentive Grants totaling over $61 million were awarded to 20 projects, with examples of such projects including
the Food Basket in Hawaii Islands Food Bank, and they call it Deluxe. Double Up Food Box program, and they're really pioneering nutrition incentives to increase the purchase of Hawaii-grown produce among SNAP beneficiaries. That local food that is grown right there, and then getting that out to those local SNAP beneficiaries.
And a project associated with Wholesome Wave Georgia.
Georgia's Fresh for Less program. That's providing over $3.6 million in fresh, again, local produce to Georgia's food insecure families, working through their partner farmers market to direct marketing farms and many avenues to get that out.
Meanwhile, 15 projects were recipients of $7.5 million in produce prescription grants.
One specific grant to look at is the Fresh Approach of Concord, California. And they're really looking at a trauma-informed veggie produce prescription program to increase access and consumption of healthy foods among low-income populations. And what this project is going to do is it's going to work directly with healthcare providers to address those root causes of health disparities in their most vulnerable patients. And so they're going to receive these food prescription vouchers with each visit, redeemable for fruits and vegetables at farmers market.
With the vouchers providing low-income patients access to better nutrition, better health behaviors, and in turn, increased food security. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA accepted offers for more than 2.5 million acres from agricultural producers and private landowners for enrollment through this year's Grassland Conservation Reserve Program sign-up. This is double last year's enrollment and brings the total acres enrolled across all CRP sign-ups in 2021 to more than 5.3 million acres. That surpassed USDA's goals. Professional managers of farmland are indicating that cash rents will rise in 2022. Todd Gleason has more on how this may impact some grain farmers.
Typically, periods of higher incomes on the farm lead to higher cash rents. That makes some sense as landowners work to keep their piece of the pie. However, increasing cash rents now holds some economic risk for farmers. There are still ways, says University of Illinois Extension agricultural economist Gary Schnittke, for them to pass on the rewards of good years to landowners while at the same time mitigating the risk of really low prices and very low farm incomes.
I personally like leases that vary payments with economic conditions. So share rents and variable cash rents would be something to consider as we're moving forward. Variable, either one of those would make pretty large payments to the landowner in 2021 because of higher prices and what looks to be higher yield or good yields across much of the state, above trend yields, maybe near record yields. So, variable cash leases and shared rental arrangements.
By the way, cash rents in the state of Illinois vary considerably. Generally, the highest payments, as reported by USDA in August, are all located in the center part of the state, with the three highest cash rent counties right at or just above $300 an acre on average. The counties along the Ohio River in deep southern Illinois, by contrast, run cash rents of less than $100 an acre, and in Johnson County, it's just $52. The reason for this difference is straightforward. It has to do with soil productivity and, thanks to the internet, those are pretty easy to find, says Schnittke.
If you go to Acre Value on Granular's website, you can locate a farm and find its soil productivity index. There's a very high correlation. There's a 0.9 correlation between those county cash rents and the soil productivity index. There is a bit of variability across the state from that. And some CRDs, crop reporting districts, have higher and some a little bit lower than that soil productivity index. But that soil productivity index does a reasonably good job of explaining the cash rents across the state.
Again, the differences in the soil productivity index, or SPI, explain a large part of the variation in cash rents. By the way, a particular farm's average cash rent can be figured using a formula. You may find this on the FarmDoc Daily website. Look for Gary Schnittke's September 7 article. The formula is cash rent equals -139 plus 2.8 times the SPI, and then you add the CRD adjustment. Again, that formula is on the FarmDoc Daily website in Schnitke's September 7 article and a couple of others. I'm Todd Gleason.
USDA released the Crop Production and Rural Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate reports. USDA is calling for higher corn and soybean production in the U.S. Corn production is forecast at 15 billion bushels. Soybean production is predicted at 4.37 billion bushels. The U.S. wheat outlook is for reduced supplies, slightly higher domestic use, unchanged exports, and decreased ending stocks. The season average farm price dropped 10 cents to $6.60 a bushel for wheat. Canada, like the U.S., has strong cultural divisions when it comes to rural versus urban, east versus west, and which side of age 35 you're on. Dennis Guy has more on how that affects agriculture.
Now, at least in Canada, COVID-19 vaccine rates are highlighting those historic divisions. As of September 1st, adult Canadians who have received at least one COVID vaccine dose stood at about 85%. Comparatively, on that same date, the adult American single-dose population stood at just under 65%. This reality has led to many Canadians feeling a bit smug, but those broad national numbers belie some uncomfortable realities. There is a stark difference in vaccine uptake within regions and within age demographics. Right now, a Canadian over age 35 living in a city or suburb east of Winnipeg has probably received at least one vaccine dose. Conversely, if you are a Canadian under age 35 and live in the country or a small town west of Winnipeg, it's very likely you have not been vaccinated. Younger adult Canadians do not see much urgency when it comes to vaccination, and that fact concerns Canada's chief medical officer, Dr. Theresa Tam.
That is the population that has been noted across the country, and they are a group that has more social mixing.
The eastern maritime provinces have the highest vaccine uptake rates in Canada. Coincidentally, the Maritimes have a generally older population. Meanwhile, Alberta, with a generally younger and more rurally oriented population, currently has the strongest fourth wave COVID outbreak in Canada. Alberta also has one of the lowest vaccine uptakes in the country. At the University of Alberta Hospital, intensive care doctor Peter Brimley says that vaccine science deniers become staunch believers once admitted.
It almost feels like people deny science right until they get to the emergency room and then they demand all the science stat.
And these days, COVID patients admitted to hospital tend to be younger adults in Alberta and across Canada. Those studying this trend think the solution to solving the problem might be found in the workplace. Younger adults are usually employees. Paul McLean, a labor lawyer in Toronto, says that avoiding vaccination due to pregnancy or due to immune system compromise are legitimate reasons. But employers will eventually be forced by their customers into giving their young employees an ultimatum.
I think that over time what you're going to see is the majority of employers will face significant pressure from their customers or their clients to make sure their employees are vaccinated. Majority employers may well be entitled to say, absent vaccination, you're not coming to work.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
Last week, the White House hosted a press conference featuring Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack and Brian Deese, the director of the National Economic Council, to discuss the meatpacking sector. Both Vilsack and Deese talked specifically about the impacts of a highly concentrated meatpacking sector for American producers and consumers. The U.S. Cattlemen's Association President Brooke Miller says that the White House seeing the need for increased competition in the marketplace is a testament to the many agricultural producer and consumer voices who have been advocating for change. Bayer Funds America's Farmers Grow Communities program is back for another year to help strengthen farming communities across the country. Michael Clements has more.
Grow Communities is open now, and farmers can enter for the chance to direct a $5,000 donation, double the previous year's amount, to a local eligible nonprofit organization, school, or ag program. Bayer Community Outreach Manager Aaron Glarner explains why the program was created.
Yes, so the program was started in 2010, and it was created for farmers to have an opportunity to partner with the Bayer Fund to strengthen rural communities. This year, we actually revamped the program to double our donation amount to $5,000. By doubling our amount, we have the opportunity to provide a greater impact in those rural communities.
Farmers are uniquely positioned through America's Farmers Grow Communities to nominate a donation to a program of their choice.
The program works by allowing farmers the opportunity to direct a donation to their nonprofit of choice. So from now until November 1st, farmers can enroll. Then in November and December, Bayer Fund will select and notify those winning farmers.
Glarner says the donations help rural communities and programs thrive.
Bayer Fund feels it's very important for farmers to play a key role in directing funds to their rural communities. Some examples include youth programs such as 4-H clubs or FFA chapters, schools with a STEM or ag program, or other organizations such as food banks. In fact, over the past decade, farmers have helped direct more than $60 million to thousands of schools and nonprofit organizations to help strengthen their communities.
Enrolling for a chance to win a Grow Communities donation is simple and just takes a couple of minutes.
Enrolling for the chance to win is really simple. Farmers can visit our website at americasfarmers.com. Again, that's americasfarmers.com. Or they can also call our toll-free number at 1-877-267-3332. Again, the deadline to enroll is November the 1st. Please visit our website at americasfarmers.com for more information.
Learn the entry requirements and enroll for a chance to direct a donation from Bayer Fund's America's Farmers Grow Communities program online at americasfarmers.com. Michael Clements reporting.
That's our news for today. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety at Western Agricultural Processors Association, about a new proposal to mandate electric forklifts for the ag industry. Welcome, Priscilla.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here today. Priscilla, my first question for you here. California Air Resources Board, or CARB, recently announced the next iteration of their large spark ignited regulation for forklifts, which is known as Forklift Rule 2.0. What does this new proposal potentially entail for the ag industry?
Absolutely. So this is, like you mentioned, this is the second iteration. So this is Forklift 2.0, as it's known, or really the large spark ignited regulation is what the official title is, but Forklift 1.0. We, in agriculture, little history, I guess, to go backwards, we were treating it a little bit differently when the initial rule came out, and there was a couple of reasons for that. But we were given different timelines and a different emissions factors to have to meet because of three things. One being that ag operations only operate seasonally, typically 3 to 4 months of the year. We are unable to pass along costs from these purchases of these expenditure costs from purchasing forklifts. And additionally, for those that use rough terrain forklifts, the technology simply does not exist for those lower emissions at the time to go any lower than what was provided to us. So we had a different timeline and we had different emission levels that we had to meet. Now, this time around, what they're saying is they want to do electric across the board. The mandate would be for everybody. Everybody would be treated equally. So potentially that would entail everyone in agriculture would be required to have electric forklifts regardless of their operation, regardless of their size.
Just comparing the original rule to this new rule, you know, you said they made some exceptions for agriculture in that old rule, but they've kind of, in a way, tossed out those exceptions now. Why have they moved in that direction, do you think?
So, and I mean, this is in line with what the administration is just going to, right? So there's been this recent push to do all electric in vehicles. There was the earlier this year, COVID kind of mixes everything up in my head. I don't know if it was earlier this year or last year, where they talked about the vehicle mandate by 2035, all vehicles would be electric. So it's definitely the administration's push to go that route. So that's hence why we see forklifts going in that way as well. So that's the difference. Now, we are working with CARB to educate them on the reasons why ag operations were treated differently in the past. And for the reasons I stated earlier, we were treated differently because we weren't able to meet those mandates. It's not cost effective for ag operations, right? We only running 3 to 4 months of the year. Your equipment is sitting there for 8 to 9 months out of the year. So it's not doing anything. There's no way to pass along those costs. I mean, if we were a warehousing operation running 12 months out of the year, that makes sense. You can break that down over time, right? And the cost doesn't seem so significant, and they have the ability to pass along those costs, and we simply don't have that ability.
Priscilla, you know, CARB now wants, you know, like I said, to treat the ag industry the same as these other manufacturing operations, and you kind of just went into it a little bit, but why is that really problematic for certain producers, you know, like tree nut producers?
Right. So like I say, I touched on it a bit, but you think about an ag operation that runs 3 to 4 months of the year, and you think about another facility, say a warehouse facility that's working 12 months out of the year, 24 hours a day. Now it's difficult to compare, right? You can't, it's not comparing apples to apples. It doesn't work that way. So to try to mandate something like that on producers who simply, it's simply not cost effective, right? It doesn't make sense to purchase it. It's like purchasing a vehicle yourself and just having it sit there for 8 or 9 months of the year. It's not doing anything. It's not producing anything. Well, we only use it for 3 to 4 months of the year, and it's not producing anything any other time of the year. So to have that capital expenditure when we cannot pass along those costs, it doesn't make sense. It's not cost effective. And I mentioned to you earlier on the rough terrain. So specifically in the tree nut industry, the rough terrain forklifts are used just because of the rough terrain, right? So whenever you're driving on, say, like a warehouse, when you're driving on cement, something that's flat, it's easy to use electric equipment. When you're talking about out in rough terrain, hills, dirt, mud, gravel, you simply can't use electric forklift because it doesn't have the capability to do that, to maneuver in those areas. And right now, as it stands, rough terrain forklifts don't have that technology available. It doesn't exist. Now, at this last CARB meeting that happened, the CARB workshop, there was a manufacturer who said that they had this low emission forklift, rough terrain forklift. So there's obviously, there's something that we can look into, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for the situation. So that has to be evaluated to see if it'll work.
They're looking into lower emissions, but that still isn't electric. Do you know of any manufacturers that are looking into electric, or is that just not really on the horizon?
Absolutely. No, that's just not in the horizon. Just for you think about the horsepower on a rough terrain is typically a lot higher than you're talking about your forklift. So it just simply does not exist. You'd have to imagine the amount of batteries you'd have to have. And it's similar to something like a tractor, right? How do you do electric tractor? You would need a trailer just with batteries to be able to operate. So it's simply just not feasible at the moment. Yeah.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Hi, we're back talking with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety at Western Agricultural Processors Association, about a new proposal to mandate electric forklifts for the ag industry. Priscilla, CARB has also indicated that they believe it is actually cheaper to own and operate an electric forklift than a propane forklift. What evidence are they using to support that claim? And is it really accurate?
So that's a great question. So the information that CARB has used to substantiate this claim that electric is a more cost effective than propane, they're using national data information. So yes, the information is accurate. They're using things like their sources are Electric Power Research Institute, American Electric Power, Propane Education Research Council. So the information shows that it's takes anywhere from 6 to 7 to 10 cents, basing it on a rate, electric rates for of 6 to 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, that's a national average, which is correct. However, that is not correct for California. We are not based on the national average. It does not reflect what we pay in California. We pay amongst the highest electricity rates across the continental US. So it wouldn't be fair to use those numbers as a way to substantiate the fact that it would be more cost effective in California to operate electric versus propane. So when you think about that, when you make that analysis, you really have to look at what California is paying. And so what we did was we surveyed our membership to see what exactly are our members paying, what are the rates here in California. And from what we had, we seen anywhere from 14 cents per kilowatt hour all the way up to 35 cents per kilowatt hour. That's a huge difference from the numbers that they're using to substantiate that claim. So clearly that is part of the education portion and being able to reach out to our membership and provide that real data to CARB really does help make a difference. So just making sure that we're presenting this information, letting them know these assumptions that are being made aren't accurate for California.
I'm kind of curious why CARB, you know, opted to use the national numbers if they must have known that it's more of a generalization than it's not specific to the state. Why would they kind of misrepresent it like that?
So I don't necessarily know why their assumption was based off these sources, but I will say that it's just simply not accurate for us. So I can't say why it was used or what the reasoning was behind it, but I just know that it's not accurate for us. Hence why we are now educating them on these are the real numbers that work for California.
Priscilla, my next question here, you talked about this a little bit already, but you know, there is a lower emissions rate that's being considered for rough terrain forklifts commonly used by tree nut haulers. You talked to the manufacturer or you kind of know what the manufacturer is offering, how feasible is that proposal? And is it nearly as severe as the electric mandate?
So there's a couple of things with this one. On the rough terrain forklift, as I mentioned, there was a manufacturer that spoke at a CARB workshop recently who said that they had this like super low emission rough terrain forklift. Now we still have to look into that. This is not something that I have vetted yet. So I can't say that it's something that exists per se. obviously, we are not necessarily against lowering, if it's feasible, whenever this is feasible. If it is feasible, it makes sense, right? So even if you're talking about electric, if it's feasible and makes sense and it's cost effective, we are not against it, but it has to be feasible. So like I mentioned earlier, there's a manufacturer who's saying it. If it's feasible and it's something that can work, then absolutely we would be supportive of it. Obviously, there's no way to do an electric mandate on rough terrain. So is it a severe? Well, it's not even a possibility there. Another thing that I would say is that at CARB's last workshop, they did also talk about exempting rough terrains from this proposal. So rough terrains could possibly be exempted. They did specifically say it was for outdoor operations on uneven grounds. So sometimes that verbiage or that language can be confusing. What does that mean, uneven grounds? Because in Trinets or Hullers, it's not necessarily uneven grounds, but you do have gravel, you do have dirt, you do have mud. So those environments don't basically allow for anything besides rough terrain forklifts. So there's just some little nuances that do need to be corrected, but nonetheless, they have considered removing rough terrain forklifts from this proposal or on this mandate, which would be a great thing.
Maybe speaking on that consideration, they're making a little more, what do you think, maybe if you can speak on this, the chances of them doing that are at this point, what information does CARB need to see to maybe make that exemption?
I think we're getting a lot closer than we were in the initial discussions of it. They did include it, like I mentioned, they did in this last workshop, they did include rough terrain forklifts as an exemption on their proposal. So I think, like I said, it's just little small nuances on the uneven grounds or verbiage that probably needs to be removed or not limiting in terms of what rough terrain is, because some folks have different definitions of what rough terrain is. So I think this is something that can definitely be worked with CARB. I don't see that one being as large of an issue at this moment in time, just because they seem like they're moving forward on the right path with the rough terrain forklifts. So it seems to be going in the right direction, but we can never say it's a win until it's a win.
All right, Priscilla, we got time for one last question here. I do know that Western Ag Processors Association is pushing back against CARB. That's been pretty obvious to what you've been saying here. But, you know, what are you guys actually doing? And, you know, maybe how can producers help?
Obviously, one of the things that we did and we thought was the most important is making sure we had accurate data. So we did send out a survey out to our membership, getting accurate information on not just electric rates, but also cost and operation and maintenance of what it actually costs, because we do have some folks who have electric forklifts. So we wanted to get that difference, right? Propane versus electric, what's the difference? What's the operational cost? So getting that information, gathering it up and being able to provide that to CARB is going to be really important. So we did receive that information from membership and we're working to compile that information to be able to present to CARB. Now, in addition to that, we are also working with CARB and other ag stakeholders, and we'll be having a meeting here pretty soon in the near future to discuss where exactly ag is on this issue. In addition to that, we will be writing comments. We're in the process of writing comments right now to CARB with all the issues that we kind of described today and letting them know what our issues are and why and making that and writing that down. So that's kind of where we're at right now in the process. They are expected to come out with another workshop in October. So we continue pushing forward on this, continue having the dialogue with CARB and other ag stakeholders that make you sure we're in coordination for this effort.
I just want to ask one last little side question here with maybe some of the submissions that you guys have gotten from your members up to this point. I don't know if you can speak on this, but maybe what are the percentages of roughly some of your members that have electric forklifts to propane?
It's a little bit different because we have both processors and haulers. So in our hauling operations, it's not feasible to have, or it's less feasible to have electric. So those numbers aren't as high. But in our processing facilities, again, where it's feasible, you can see some processing facilities, a third of their fleet is electric or a quarter of their fleet is electric. So it really just depends on the operation, the type, the grounds, and whether or not it's feasible. So it really just depends and varies. But we've seen quite a bit of operations have both forklift and electric. Again, propane forklifts and electric forklifts, but propane is going to be the majority right now.
Well, this is obviously a serious issue coming amongst some of these other regulations for electric vehicles, agriculture at the moment. Hopefully, Western Ag Processors Association and CARB can come to some form of an agreement or at least meet in the middle on this as it benefits haulers and shellers and other producers. Thank you, Priscilla, for coming on today and providing some insight on that.
You're welcome, Taylor. Is it okay to add something?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that I did want to add is, aside from what WAPA is doing right now, I think another thing that's important for us to work with on CARB is making sure that we create an incentive program around this as well, just like other incentive programs that have been for tractor, ATVs, ag pumps. So there have been very successful incentive programs that have helped both, you know, it's a dual process. So where it's CARB, the air district and agriculture working together to turn over those types of equipment. So something like that, some program like that, I think is going to be perfect or ideal when we're trying to talk about some type of a mandate for forklifts. So doing something of that nature is going to be key as well.
Okay. Well, we hope to see a program like that sooner on the horizon there. I think, you know, like you said, that could be really beneficial for maybe adopting some of these practices. Thank you for noting that and for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Taylor.
Of course. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.